This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Daily news reports warn us of the impact that our carbon footprint is having on our planet. We're told to change how we live and what we drive. But could our pets themselves, what and who we feed them, contribute to their environmental paw print? We pamper our dogs and cats like children, but we're told by pet food companies that we need to feed them like wolves and bobcats. But is this the best diet for them? Could these ancestral diets be contributing to their rise in obesity and climate destruction? What can we do that's easy, safe, and nutritious, and possibly reverse climate change, or at least slow it down? My guest is Dr. Ernie Ward, an internationally recognized veterinarian, author, and lecturer from North Carolina, with expertise in senior pet care, pain management, nutrition, and founder of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. He is releasing a book that is sure to lead to a paradigm shift for all pet families and those concerned with those. Are they providing the best for their pets? And very much so, the veterinarians who care for them. We're going to be right back after this short break. Please stay tuned. There are just certain smells that bring me just absolute joy. The smell of a wood fire, burnt marshmallows, and bug spray. Those are all scents that remind me of tent camping when I was a kid in Yosemite National Park in California. Those are my happy smells. But there are some smells that you find in a house that you should never encounter, and that's a litter box. What I found that works fabulously is Arm & Hammer Clump & Seal. It seals and destroys the odor on contact for 7 days of an odor-free home. Guaranteed. Now, I personally think you should scoop your box on a daily basis, but sometimes you gotta let that box wait a day or two. So don't let your house smell like a litter box. Get Arm & Hammer Clump & Seal. Arm & Hammer. More power to you.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Dr. Ward, thank you so much. I know that you're an extremely, extremely busy person, and to have you on my show is a deep honor.
Bernadine, the honor is all mine to be able to share this time with your listeners. It really is thrilling.
I mentioned this book that you've written, and I had the opportunity, thank you very much, to read a copy, and it was mind-altering for me. It was just amazing. I try to be that good person. I try to be the good pet owner, and I see there's so much I need to do. So the book, The Clean Pet Food Revolution, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, you know, Bernadine, like you, as a veterinarian, as a lifelong vegan and vegetarian, I didn't think I was part of the problem. You know, I didn't realize the contribution that the pet patients that I love and serve were actually part of this bigger problem with climate change and animal welfare and, you know, all of these environmental ills that you hear. And so, like you mentioned, I sort of had put my head in a hole, pretended to be an ostrich and said, I'm not part of the problem, I'm the solution. And then in 2017, a study from UCLA really rocked my world. And in it, Dr. Gregory Okun, who's the lead researcher there, wanted to examine the contributions to greenhouse gas emissions, to pesticides, to water destruction, all of these, again, environmental issues that pet food and the pet food industry contributed. And in the briefest of summaries, he concluded that, one, about 25 to 30% of all animal-derived calories, that's meat-based calories, were being consumed in the U.S. by dogs and cats. So that's about a quarter of all meat eaten in the U.S. was being eaten by our dogs and cats. And he then postulated that if these dogs and cats in the U.S. were a country unto themselves, they would be the fifth largest in the world in terms of meat consumption. So that started to get my attention. But then the second part really rocked me to the core, because then he said, look, they are contributing, the pet food industry is contributing to over 30% of all of the environmental destruction, the greenhouse gas emissions, and all these other problems that I thought I was solving. And so, Bernadine, when that came out, I had no choice but to act. And that's actually what set in motion us starting our pet food company, Wild Earth. You know, I was already feeding my dogs, you know, plant-based diets, but, you know, I wanted to do more. And that's what led us to not only found a pet food company, but to write a book.
What I find just really amazing is here I am, a veterinarian who really tries to stay on top of the newest information to make sure that I can educate my clients as to giving the best foods that are out there. And, you know, I've been wondering for quite a while now with this real push for all of these high meat diets. You know, it's organic, it's natural. I always laugh and tease with my clients that I think these pets are eating better than I'm eating.
Right.
For the quality that's going in there. But I don't think they, or like you were saying, we're aware of what we're doing. So you getting this information and you being so on top of this, the amount of greenhouse gases, and it's not just the United States that pets have become such a part of the family, really looking at what's going on in China and India and all these. But why do you think there's such a disconnect? Why have we been kept in the dark as to these effects?
Yeah, you know, Bernadine, that's a great question, and the one that I ask myself. I ask myself, why wasn't I made aware of this? Why wasn't I aware of this? And I think that the information was there very subtly. It was, you know, not being the focus, though, of the conversation. And look, to listeners today, I'm not saying that if we simply clean up pet food that we solve all of the world's problems. But what I am saying is that we now are a major contributor. If we're contributing to a third of meat consumption and greenhouse gas emissions and destruction of water and so forth, then I want to take action as a veterinarian, as a pet owner, and a pet lover. So, you know, again, Bernadine, I think that the reason that it hasn't been discussed and the reason we weren't made aware was because it just wasn't the focus of the media. It wasn't the focus of the industry. And you're right. These ancestral, biologically appropriate, all these marketing terms, you know, have really overwhelmed the public. And so now most pet owners like you, when I'm in the exam room and here I am as an obesity expert, you know, people are saying, but wait, dogs need more meat to stay healthy. And you're sort of like going, okay, dogs and cats need nutrients. They don't need ingredients, which is why a major part of the book, you know, I describe this ingredient bias. So this is a term that I came up with several years ago to say, why aren't people looking at alternative ingredients? Because we have been conditioned and quite frankly, you know, sort of hoodwinked into believing that ingredients are the secret to health. And really, it's the nutrients contained. In fact, one of the things that I call in the book, Bernadine, is I say that ingredients, so like chicken, let's say, or a pea, that's a nutrient vessel. An ingredient is a nutrient vessel. It's simply a way to get the amino acids, the vitamins, the minerals, the fats, the carbohydrates into the body. The body doesn't care where those nutrients are sourced. They don't care if it's a chicken or a buffalo or a fungi. They just care that it contains the amino acids essential for life.
But I think so many of us have gotten this bad idea of GMO, genetically modified organisms. And I know in your book, you're calling it Frankenfoods, you know, things that are just produced in a lab that cannot be healthy because that's not natural. How would you respond to that?
Yeah. And again, this is a common, you know, fallacy. It's called the nature fallacy. And that is this belief. And look, it's hard baked into our beings, but that somehow that things that are more natural are more healthy. And it's just simply not true. If this were true, of course, we would never introduce a vaccine into our bodies. We wouldn't be drinking the amounts of water. We wouldn't be concerned about whether or not we got an adequate exercise. I mean, so the fact is that just because something arrived or was derived from nature doesn't mean it's healthier. Again, what you have to look at now, also this part of this nature fallacy is, okay, let's take that for an extension. Let's say, well, dogs and cats need meat. Well, what did they evolve eating? They didn't evolve eating cows. dogs and cats didn't evolve eating salmon and chickens and whatever else. You know, we want pigs. So this is really where it gets complicated. What evolution does is it selects for the nutrients, the fundamental building blocks of life. And it says, wherever you can source that, we're going to help you digest it, which really gets us back to the how I think what is so exciting about the future of food is the fact that we now have entered into an era where we can actually dial up specific nutrient profiles for individuals. And over the next decade, you're going to see this complete revolution, which is why we call the book The Pet Food Revolution, because you're going to see us now be able to say, okay, you are a 55-year-old male. You have a history of high cholesterolemia. You're thin. You don't smoke. You exercise regularly. What are the nutrients that you need to prevent disease? Because I think also, Bernadine, one of the things that pet owners and people in general want to talk about more is how do I preserve health more than how do I treat disease? I would much rather stay healthy. And if food is part of that whole prescription for good health, then I'm going to be the first person to say, let's figure out how to make that happen.
So using that food as medicine or using the food, the nutrients, the
right.
basis of it.
And the evolution of this, because this goes back to, you know, to Plato, and this goes back to the very early foundations of medicine, letting food be thy medicine. But when we really look at what's happening in technology, it's now we have the ability to create nutrient packets, these nutrient vessels that are specific to individuals. And so what we've done with our pet food company, quite frankly, is we've just taken fungal proteins and enhanced them. So now we can make a fungal protein that has the exact same amino acid composition that steak does, or we could use chicken, but it has all of those 10 essential amino acids for dogs. And then we can actually amplify that. So we can now go into the laboratory and begin to make a specific yeast organism or even bacteria. I mean, it's amazing what's going to happen with clean meats. We go into great detail talking about all these lab-grown meats and so forth. But you can actually now specify, I would like more taurine. I would like more methionine and cysteine, which is actually what we did with this particular fungal strain that we're working with for our food.
I know people are listening to this going, there is no way that it can be healthy. There's no way that it can be safe. You know, this is something that's done in a lab. And also, it can't be tasty and something that my pet is going to be willing to eat. But here you're saying that in your book that you've been feeding your pets this particular food and they're thriving on it.
Oh, yeah. But remember, too, all we've done is hack history. So we use one of the main fungal proteins that we use is something called koji. And if you've ever had sake, if you've ever had miso, if you've ever had
Yum.
Bean paste, over 2 billion people eat koji every day. And so all we did was simply take that particular fungal strain, which already is a rich source of nutrients, and it's very flavorful. The reason that you love miso soup so much and you love soy sauce so much is because of that umami flavor that koji, a yeast protein, is actually imparting. So all we did was just sort of hack into that and say, how can we make this more efficiently? And that's really what led us to say, look, we can produce the world's first high-protein plant-based dog food. So our dog food has 31% protein, highly digestible. In fact, in our studies, we show that it is more digestible than meat. So, you know, it's one of these, I think what we're entering into is this awakening. I think that Beyond Meat and the Impossible Burger, you know, it really opened a lot of people's palates and their stomachs to this idea that plant-based foods could be really delicious. And that's really where we started as well. Could we make a pet food that was not only we thought more healthy and better for the planet, but also that dogs would really love it? And so far, we've been very successful.
I think so many people have subconscious bias that they aren't aware of. So to say, and I know you're very upfront, you're a vegan. And so many people, when they hear that someone's a vegan or here's something I'd like you to try that's vegan, it's like, oh, I already know. It's going to taste bad. It's going to be icky. And you're some type of a radical because you want me to eat vegan. Only strange people are vegans.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you go, oh, the Impossible Burger. That's kind of different. So I'll be willing to try that. And I have to admit, I sought out a restaurant last time I was in Washington, D.C. that was known for their Impossible Burgers,
right.
Founding Farmers. And I ordered it. It looked like meat. It tastes like meat. It smelled like meat. The texture was off a little bit, But if I didn't know, it was wonderful. I loved it. So I think that we have to get over that hump of these bias that we have. So fungi, okay, we eat mushrooms. That's not too weird. Plant-based foods, okay. But you're also talking in your book about insect-based foods.
Yeah, we do. And Purina came out this year with a cricket-based diet. Although I will say I'm a bit more critical. I co-wrote this with Alice Oven, an animal ethicist friend of mine in the UK. And of course, Ryan Bethencourt, our CEO at Wild Earth. And, you know, I'm not a fan of insect proteins because I do have some ethical issues around that. You know, I do believe that, you know, animals feel pain. I mean, I think it's pretty well established. We go into a lot of the research in the book. But you're right. There's an entire palette, a spectrum of foods that are eaten all around the world that we just really are sort of biased against here in the U.S., which is why, you know, the first part of the book, I try to explain to readers why you feel the way you feel when somebody says vegan, why you feel the way you feel when somebody says, here's an insect protein or a plant protein or a fungal protein, because all of these biases, you know, are sort of a cultural concern for me, because obviously in the Western, you know, world, in Western Europe and the U.S., North America, we have a certain food palate that we have grown up with over the past 200 or 300 years, or in Europe, thousands of years. And yet when you then cross the border into Asia, suddenly now the dinner plate looks very different. And you have to sort of ask yourself, why is this? It's cultural. If it's cultural, that doesn't mean it's biological. What is the biological driver of these things? Which is really, you know, why I'm excited about the future of food.
It is one of those things where I think people are more willing to be adventurous with their taste buds and try different foods. It's, you know, you may not know and may have never been to China, but, oh, I love Chinese food. And yes, the way that we've Americanized it here is so different. And our pets don't really have that bias. We do, and we need to change our thinking as to what we put in our bowl. But a bias that I have right now is a bias that we're going to need to take a short break to talk to our sponsors. And we're going to be right back with Dr. Ernie Ward talking about this great way of feeding our pets with the clean pet food revolution. We're going to be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
I have two dogs, Sam and Bailey. Both are golden retrievers. Poor Sam, he was a mess. Always itching, his paws were soaking wet all day from just constant licking. He had bald spots on his back. I just don't like putting shots and steroids into your dog all the time.
DinoVite.com. DinoVite is nutrition.
Probably 2 weeks after he started DinoVite, I started seeing great improvements, and today 99% of his issues are non-existent. It's amazing stuff. Since Bailey has been 12 weeks old, he's been a DinoVite dog, and he has zero issues today. He won't eat his food without DinoVite. When I get out the DinoVite, my dogs actually salivate, like I'm getting them a treat. They drool over it. DinoVite is the best thing you can do for your dog.
You won't believe how happy your dog will be.
I get my DinoVite from DinoVite.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Ward, in your book, you talk about the disconnect that people have with where their pet's food comes from. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to be at a local county fair. I was doing some work there. And I was listening to people, and I love eavesdropping and people watching. And this young mother with a child was there, and they were looking at a little goat. And the child wanted to know, what's that? And she goes, it's a baby cow. It's like, oh. You ask people, oh, so where does your milk come from? Comes from the store. That's nice. Where did that milk come from? Cow. How did they get it? They just don't know. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about the impact of we care so much about our dog and cat. And just before the break, you were talking about cultural norms. So here in the United States, the thought of eating horse meat is just a major point of contention. And in Asia, it was eating dog meat, and that you would have some dogs that are their pets and some dogs that they're eating. Could you kind of go into that a little bit?
Yeah, we do describe that. It is hypocritical. Why do we favor certain species of animals over others? Why is it okay to eat one, vilify another, and then cradle and sleep with the final set of species? And the speciesism really does confuse us. And look, you know, there's no solution to that, but it is an awareness that we have to, I think, come to as a species ourselves. Because what has happened now is that human beings, the scale of factory farming has reached unprecedented levels. And at any given time, there are approximately, 40 to 60 billion animals that are living in a factory farm around the world. And so I think we've done a great job, especially in the U.S., of sort of shuttering that away. And so most people don't know where the milk comes from or the cheese that they have on their cheeseburger or the meat that even goes into the patty. And so I do go into some detail, and some of it's a bit graphic, but we talk about actually what is involved in the steps of getting from the farm to the table. And it's not always pretty. And in fact, I would argue that most of the time, especially in the United States, it is not. In fact, a recent estimate by the government says that 95% of all of the animal proteins that you eat, that you ate for breakfast, lunch, dinner, tonight, came from a factory farm. And nobody is really hiding that fact. It's just a fact of how the scale that we've come to, why we can enjoy, having a dollar Big Mac or whatever it might be. So again, there's a lot to this system that I wanted to uncover, because you're right, Bernadine, as a veterinarian, it is very easy for me to sort of just put that to the side, shuffle it under the carpet and say, you know what, it's really not my concern. But I did take an oath to eliminate animal suffering. And so for me, this is part of that belief in my oath. And that is the fact that I do believe that dairy cows suffer, that beef cattle suffer, that pigs and chickens and farm salmon and, even insects may suffer. And so we get into this big philosophical debate of, we now have entered into an era when we can feed ourselves and feed our pets with compassion. We don't have to continue to engage in these old ways of doing things. And in fact, the ways that we are grazing, making meat now, is destroying the planet. I mean, the Amazon forest is just one of those examples. There's forest fires in Siberia that are all related to how we are changing the landscape to grow crops, to feed animals that we then eat. And it's an incredibly inefficient system. So, I mean, when you just look at the economics of it and the scale, the water usage and so forth, you go, wow, why do we continue to persist in these highly inefficient systems? And then in the U.S., we subsidize it with the U.S. Farm Bill. So we're now subsidizing these industries that are not only destroying the planet, but they're not good for the economy. And all these, look, my entire family came from family farms. Okay. My mother and father are the only two that actually left the farm. And yet none of my family engages in farming anymore because the U.S. American small family farm is bankrupt. It's out of business. And what's it been replaced by? These massive conglomerates. And again, I know we've gotten a little off tangent, Bernadine, but I wanted to talk about that in the book. We talk about the economies and how decoupling, actually farm and taxpayer monies from farming, because we're just supporting these systems that ultimately are unsustainable.
I think we all want that good, cheap food. And I know there's times, I was getting away from red meat and doing more chicken and fish and went to a local store and purchased this roasted chicken. It was gorgeous. It tasted fabulous. And I'm looking at this thing and it has this huge breast. And I'm thinking, okay, put the feathers and the legs and the head back on this creature. And what did it look like before? Thankfully, it made it to my plate. And I realized this little guy couldn't stand, walk. It must have been very unhealthy. We think, and I was looking at these various ads that come up sometimes on my YouTube feed for a type of organic chicken. And it has this bucolic view of, it's out there and it's pecking at the grass. It's like, that's not where it came from. And cage free. It's still in a large building. It's not outside on the grass eating this wonderful little bugs. So people have gotten, as you're saying, so far removed from the farm, we don't even think about where our food comes from. And I think that we are being kept in the dark by industry itself.
And look, I don't blame listeners. You know, this is not the kind of content that you really want to subject yourselves to on a daily basis. You really shouldn't have to have this ethical conundrum and this moral dilemma every time you decide what you want to feed your family for dinner.
Right. I need to eat.
Right. We need to eat. And there's also cost pressure. So all of this stuff is really where we are. What we find, though, is that as we embrace this new wave of future foods, not only is it going to be healthier for us, but it's going to be less expensive. And that's the part, too, that this is why you see people like Mars Pet Care. Bernadine was one of the early investors in my company, Wild Earth. Why
wow.
would they invest in us? You know, now, why we took their money is another complicating factor. But they invested in people like us because they said, wait a second, these people are doing something differently. We know that's the future. We want to make sure that we understand the technology and how hopefully we can benefit from it. So all of the big companies, Tyson is invested heavily in Impossible Beyond. You know, all of these major players, Purdue is looking at again, plant-based chicken replacements and lab-grown meat for their company. They're doing this not just because they've grown an ethical conscience, Bernadine. They know that it's going to be cheaper in the future. And so that's really
profit.
Where this thing heads. Yeah. Over the next decade, I think, you know, if we could fast forward, if somebody would go back and replay this one decade from now, so in 2030, we're going to laugh at a lot of this conversation because we're going to be like, wow, we were so afraid of that. It seems so groundbreaking and you know, science fiction-esque, and then you're going to realize, wow, this is what I order now at the fast food restaurant. So it's happening so quickly, and it's just a really, really exciting time to be alive.
One of the things you mentioned, Dr. Ward, was, you know, the people get so invested in what they're feeding, and I always have to laugh when I go into my office call and I'm talking about health and preventive care and talking about nutrition. People are so adamant about right. what they're feeding their pet, and this is going to be the best food for them. I know several years ago, it was in Los Angeles, maybe a year or two ago, where I read an article in one of my local journals about there was some crazy person who was trying to feed all the animals in our LA shelter vegetarian food, going, that is absolutely crazy. They cannot live on a vegetarian diet. And after reading your book, it's like, oh, yes, I need to rethink this.
And the LA animal shelter, that got so distorted in the mass media. You know, it really was frustrating for those of us that were involved in that because basically it was set out to be a pilot program to feed dogs a vegetarian diet, an established vegetarian diet, quite frankly, that was made in California near LA. So there was, you know, it was like, wow, this stuff is already AFCO approved. And then it got twisted into this big giant thing where they're trying to feed all the animals vegan diets and Moby gets involved and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you're right. You know, I make this joke over the past 5 or 6 years in my lectures, Bernadine. It goes like this. If you want to start a fight, ask somebody what they feed their pet. Because mm-hmm. it has become this new religion, this political taboo conversation. If you ask somebody about feeding their pet, again, we're so emotionally invested, as you put it so well, and that we just suddenly go, wait a second, you're now somehow attacking my personal parenting of my pet. And it's just, we've got to transcend beyond all of this and really become more open-minded. But, you know, hey, look, I get it. The boundaries are clearly drawn right now. There are a lot of people that say, my side is nuts. And then, you know, some of people on my side go, well, the other side's nuts. I kind of say, let's all be scientific about it. Let's look at what the actual nutritional requirements are and how can we do this in a compassionate way that maybe can slow down or eliminate or reverse, if we're lucky, climate change. Bernadine, I don't know that we're going to actually be able to solve climate change. I think that when we fast forward to 10 years, you know, our children are really going to be inheriting an atmosphere, a climate that is going to be very different than what we have today. And then in another 50 years, you know, where I live here on the beautiful North Carolina coast, you know, my house could be underwater.
You're talking about feeding dogs this vegetarian food and how people are just so emotionally involved in this. And I can see that, yes, dogs in the terminology we've used for a long time are omnivores, can eat a little bit of whatever. And I will tell my clients when, you know, you have that wolf, you want to go back to the wolf where things now are being grain free and grain is bad. Going, think about that wolf. When it took down the alpha, took down that elk, it didn't go for that haunch and have that big piece of meat. It oftentimes went for the entrails, the guts, and what's in the guts. And all of a sudden you see this light come on in the client's eyes going, grains and you know, vegetable material going, yeah, so that's something that our dogs can eat. But we've been talking all about dogs. Then there's the cat.
Cats.
So the cat is going to be that carnivore. The obligate carnivore is what I always heard in veterinary school, that it has to have that meat. But you're now telling me it's the nutrients, it's not the meat.
Yeah, and that's what we were taught too. We were taught nutrients, not ingredients. Nutrients are the how you know we stay alive and thrive. And right now, I'll just tell you, if you're listening today, the terms omnivore, carnivore, we have to stop using them. Those are outdated 18th century taxonomic terminology that we've tried to adulterate by saying, even you, Bernadine, caught yourself there saying carnivore, obligate carnivore. We invent these adjectives that we insert before these terms to try to make them more specific or accurate. And we just have to get away from that. In fact, in the book, you know, I go out and lay sort of how this new taxonomical device and nomenclature will move. And basically what's going to happen is we just look at the amino acid requirements, the macro and micronutrient requirements of species. That's really, you know, we can't look at their skeletons. You can't look at their jaw. You can't look at the length of their intestinal tract. That's really nonsense. That doesn't tell us the true story of the biology. Then there's another part of this that we go into, the microbiota or the microbiome, the gut bacteria that we talk about all the time. Well, they are also evolving at the same time that dogs. So dogs and humans have had this complex relationship for, you know, 30 to 50,000 years. And so we now know that there are significant genetic differences between dogs and wolves. So while they were co-evolving with us and their genes are changing to make them more adaptable to certain fats and carbohydrates, so were their bacteria. Well, now cats and humans have a more complex and complicated, anybody that lives with a cat knows this. We don't actually domesticate them. They just sort of allow us to
tolerate us,
with
yes.
them. That's right. As long as we feed them. And so, but one of the things that isn't talked about, in addition to some of the genetic changes that cats are currently undergoing, and that you might even hear my cat in the background, but also their gut microbiome is changing. And we're doing exciting research to sort of evaluate how cats have adapted to eat more carbohydrates. Because if you're feeding a commercial food right now, if you're going to the grocery store, the pet store, your veterinarian's office and buying a bag of food, it's majority carbohydrates. It's already corn and grains and so forth. So we go, how have they been living like this? You know, my last cat lived nearly 17 years of age. How did this happen? Because not only in addition to their own genetics adapting and evolving, but also their gut microbiome. So we go into great detail in the book to explain why these terms are really irrelevant these days. They don't make any sense in the terms of nutritional biology. And more importantly, how can we now use this information to make diets that are better for dogs and cats? Because at the end of the day, Bernadine, this is what you and I are trying to do. We are just trying to make the world a little better for the dogs and cats and horses and cows and goats and so forth that we serve. And for me, that approach over the past 20 years has been, let's look at nutrition. And this is one more step in that journey.
I know we could continue on with this conversation for another half hour, an hour at least. But as we're kind of getting towards the end of this particular segment, I know you were the founder of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. And you, right now you were talking about the slow evolution of how what we're feeding our animals have changed, how we've domesticated them. And there is this relationship you're showing between what we're putting in their bowl, their longevity, and their obesity. Can you touch on that quickly?
Right. Well, that's my passion. You know, I really backed into all of this because of my interest and experience and research in pet obesity. And so for me, you know, when I look at, okay, what are the reasons that our dogs and cats and ourselves are having more and more instances of obesity, you know, you really can't escape the diet. Now, obviously, it's much more complex. There's genetics, you know, there's going to be hormonal imbalances, disease states, there's environmental pollutants, microplastics really do concern me. There's a lot of things in foods that we aren't really aware of that we do talk about in the book. But obesity is really where it started for me. And that's why what I am doing, especially like with this first dog food iteration, you know, Bernadine, if you look at what I did exactly what I've been prescribing for weight loss for 20 years. That is a high protein, high dietary fiber food, right? So that is one of the standard ways to maintain a healthy body weight for humans and dogs and cats, and certainly help you lose weight. So really, it's been nice and exciting to say, what's the latest in technology? What's the latest in nutritional science? And then how can we actually make that into a pet food that we can sell in a store or online or wherever? So that's really where we are. I will say right now, if you're listening today, the most important question you must ask your veterinarian is, what is my dog or cat's current body condition score? And really, let's sit down and have an honest conversation and say, your cat is 2 pounds overweight. Your cat is 6 pounds overweight. Your dog needs to lose 15 pounds. That is the most important conversation you will have in the entire lifespan of your dog or cat. Because, Bernadine, as you and I know all too well, most of these conditions that we ultimately are now calling chronic or terminal conditions originate with excess adipose tissue, excess fat tissue, because it's all of the inflammatory mediators, the hormones and chemicals that that fat tissue produces that then go on to create diabetes, that cause hypertension, kidney failure, right? Osteoarthritis. Yes.
All those things we see every day.
Right. And so when I go and I say, that's the most important question, I truly mean that. Now, then the second question you have to ask is, what am I feeding my pet? How much am I feeding my pet?
Your categories. Right? Yes, the most important, Dad. Keep going.
Right. That gets us back to calories and then nutrient composition, which you can see now. I mean, I am on this crusade where over the next 5 years, we will be able to, if not completely personalize your pet's diet, we'll be able to get you within a category of, you know, several types, phenotypes for your pet. And that's going to happen over the next 5 years. The research that we're conducting right now, it is so exciting. And I, you know, again, you wish you could share everything that you're doing with the world, but you can't because there's obviously competition. But I can tell you that we are quickly approaching a time when we're going to be able to do some simple diagnostic tests, ask you some simple questions, evaluate your pet's certain biometric data, and then say, this is the nutrient composition that your cat or dog needs to try to maintain ideal health, to try to prevent as many diseases as possible. More importantly, to extend longevity and improve quality of life. Because at the end of the day, what breaks my heart more than anything is to see that 95-pound Labrador who is suffering with every step, to see that 18-pound cat who has to be administered twice a day insulin injections. These are pets that are suffering. And honestly, at the end of the day, I took an oath, as we've already mentioned, and I want to eliminate and alleviate that suffering whenever possible. This is just one other way that I'm trying to attack that.
Dr. Ward, thank you very much for everything that you've been doing to enlighten our pet owners, especially enlighten the veterinarians, so we can have that impact. Closing words, where can people learn more about this book and your pet food?
Yeah, The Clean Pet Food Revolution, How Better Pet Food Will Change the World. It's available on Amazon. You can also go to thecleanpetfoodrevolution.com. And if you want to find out more about what I'm doing in the pet food space, definitely check out wildearth.com. That's wildearth.com. And, you know, again, if you have questions, don't hesitate to reach out.
Thank you so much for being a guest today. I really have been educated. That's why I love doing this show. So you've been listening to Dr. Ernie Ward. He is, as you can tell, passionate about trying to improve the health of people, pets, and our planet. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz, the pet doctor. Please tune in again next week. We'll give you more information on how to be that best possible pet owner. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.